You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Stephanie Strickland. Stephanie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Stephanie, what are you working on at the moment? I know you're going to be also reading some poems during this interview, but to begin with, what are you working on now or involved with?
Well, I've just completed a new and selected volume that's just been published, which is called How the Universe is Made. And it's so to prepare that, I've had to go through all of my work and see what the through lines are. And the other thing I'm working on is I'm part of a series called Using Electricity at Counterpath Press, which is computer-generated works for print. And that will be coming out later in the year, and that's called Ringing the Changes, and it's based on the ancient art of tower bell ringing in England. That itself was one of the very earliest forms of set theory, actually, in practice. Practiced by people who knew nothing about it, but who could feel it in their bodies, you know. And so there's many changes, many patterns that exist for that, and we chose one to write code for. And I have drawn from a number of contemporary writers and assembled their little quotes from them along the patterns of this bell ringing. So anyway, those are the two main things, yeah.
That sounds fascinating. I'd like to hear more about that, but let me ask you about the collected work that you were just saying, as you look through, you were trying to find, in compiling that volume, a through line to your work, which is very interesting. So what did you find? Because as looking back on work, I know that's always such a curious thing for writers, for artists. Work is then, you know, kind of seen through a different lens when you've made all this work afterwards. So what were some of the through lines that you saw, and were you surprised by them?
Well, I wasn't surprised that there was a great deal of focus on women and on feminist thinking. I long ago was trying to find a woman's language, and I wrote a poem called On First Looking into Derringer's The Alphabet, A Key to the History of Mankind, which in fact is an actual book about the history of language. So I wasn't surprised at that, but I was a little bit surprised to see how central the body itself was. My first book was called Give the Body Back, and the new poems are gathered under the title of The Body Obsolete, but the malleability, even the hackability of the body, the drift in the body in our time, all of that seemed to me to be persistent. And for me, the body is the source and ground of abstraction. I interact a lot with people who are engineers, mathematicians, architects, and the theories that these people used were always grounded in, either they were grounded in actual physical perceptions of the person, or in the case of someone like von Neumann, he needed an engineering kind of a guy, handy guy, Julian Bigelow, to actually work out his most advanced thinking. So the body and the way the body is seen came up a lot. I noticed if you'd ask me if I wrote about birds, I wouldn't necessarily have said so, but I found there was four poems about birds that I had written, and the first was about a hummingbird, which is something I saw at my grandmother's window, and that kind of bird is only in the Western Hemisphere, and the whole point about that poem was like a bird spending all this energy just to stand still over that flower. And then the next bird I wrote about was part of the Simone Weil book, and it was called Unconverted Bead Sparrow, and it drew on the little story of Bead told about Sparrow. He was trying to convert people to Christianity, and this sparrow out in the winter and everything found itself inside the Mead Hall for a brief moment of warmth, I suppose, is what Bede was seeing it as. But from the point of view of my poem, this sparrow was really glad to get out of that meat hole with those chickens and emerge at the other end. And then the third time I encountered it, I went back even further, and it was a talk about Philomel, the Greek myth, which involved the rape of women, of course. And then the last poem was called Rara Avis, and which is the name of Eduardo Katz's telepresence installation. And now we have the technological bird, which is manipulated by people all around the world, sharing the sensors mediated across the network inside an aviary of birds that are flying. And so a huge shift in the body of these birds and their sources.
And you're talking about electronic means now, the web, is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, no, this was an installation where you could access it over the web as well as go and see it in person. I don't know if you know that I've done a great number of, I've done about 11 digital poems, things that are accessible only over the web, so my work does move between print and screen in various forms, various kinds of software. But this a work that Eduardo Katz made was an actual, with the body of an owl, seemed to be an owl, but with camera eyes and, you know, able to be electronically touched and seen from both in the gallery and around the world on the web.
So I want to hear some of your poems, but I also want the listeners to know a little bit more about using electricity so they understand your relationship with the digital world. Can you give me a sense of that book? You talked about it a little bit at the beginning, but it's kind of a complex area, so I'd love to hear a little more about perhaps that book and your work there.
Well, you mean the New and Selected book?
Yeah, not the New and Selected book. Well, was Using Electricity, you mentioned that was another book, Using Electricity.
Well, no. Oh, Using Electricity. Oh, yes, the Ringing the Changes thing. Well, yes, that hasn't come out yet, but that will be a printed book. It's just that the text of that book was generated by a computer program, which based on a mathematics of a very ancient practice of tower bell ringing. In the New and Selected, there's sections from all of the books, and the end part is poems procedural, generative, kinetic, and hypertextual, which deals with the 11 poems that I have made with various softwares. What I said about the... I can tell you what I... If you want a little more description about ringing the changes, is that what you were asking for?
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about ringing the changes, because that I didn't completely understand that. That escaped me a little bit when you first described it.
Okay, well, it's complicated.
I know it is. I know it is. So it's. But let's,
okay,
let's
let me get to... let me see if I can... I'm trying to get to the... page in the document. Okay. Ringing the changes, I read you what I've said about it. Ringing the changes is an homage to the art of bell ringing. Ordinary folk in 17th century England sought to ring all 7 factorial permutations, all the different arrangements of changes possible with 7 bells. There's 5,040 of those. Their quest to perform mathematical patterns with their bodies is reinaugurated here using code and sighted language. A full peal would be all the permutations, but today sort of shorter method sequences are rung, and one of those is called the scientific triples peal, which is what we implemented in Python code. So a method performance visits a great number of changes, but only once each. In the ringing world, this constraint is called truth. To repeat any row would make the performance false. In my book, I gave each bell, I made a random element. I gave each bell 23 sounds analogous to like overtones, and each is a voice, a short text to read or view as a score. And in any run of the code, one of those 23 is randomly assigned to its bell. And then on the page, you have all seven bells with one of the sounds that could be attributed to each. And then you go through enough of them that you have a chance to see all these 23 reassembled seven times in the course of the book, which would make it a 161-page book. So the words allude to changes that need to be rung. I mean, there's quotes from Simone Weil and Sylvia Winter and Yokui and Hito Sterile and people who are very concerned with what's going on today and the changes that are needed.
Let's talk about the next poem you're going to read, and thank you for that. That's, of course, a complex subject that there'll be links to here so people can learn more about it. But thank you for that. And what are you going to read
first? Well, I'm
going
to say that the old woman, a very famous folkloric figure, has many incarnations throughout my work. Mother Goose, the Witch of Endor, the Irish-Scottish Hag of Bear, Ice Age Timekeeper, among others. And I have her address, the scientists who developed the bomb, abolitionists, genetic engineers, and the 19th century poetic and scientific geniuses, Emily Dickinson and Willard Gibbs. Willard Gibbs from Yale, of course. And both of those characters have a very big presence in my book. But this is an evocation of that mythic old woman, which is a bit of a description, but it's also sort of calling out to her. It's called Who, and that it glides into the first line. Who, then, sweeps them loose? Who diffuses broken, shining bits, the far-flung force washed to foam on a rock face, succulents and whelks alive inside its raising spray? Who slings the broth aslide in cups of ocean swell? Whose bolt of lace? A great spill of it blowing in the window with her pins, patterns the firmament, patterns the phosphorescent body of an eel making slip knots in the dark sea, patterns fireflies sailing through grass at the edge of a wood lit and unlit at twilight, giving body to the air or to some brimming being whose who.
I love that. Thank you so much. It feels so song-like. I mean, I guess because the words are so beautiful and even the way it ended, it's just beautiful sounding. The sound of that is gorgeous.
Well, thank you.
So you're going to read another one. I know there's two more. Is this next one from the same volume or something?
Well, it's all from the collective volumes. They're from different sections of it. This one is. The other woman who has influenced me so much that I wrote a whole book about her, called The Red Virgin, is Simone Weil, the French philosopher, mystic, resistance fighter in World War II. And this is a poem based on the kind of things that she thought. It's very short. It's called Necessity. If the sea should alter the long movement of its waves to spare a boat, it would not be beautiful. But being at every point obedient to infinitesimal pressure of wind, water, light, being nothing but obedient, it moves us. We are moved to venture on it, not because the sea will part for us.
I love that. Thank you so much, Stephanie. Should we read one more? I'd love to hear one more.
Okay. Well, this is, I write a lot about science and math and technology, and and this is another kind of necessity. It's called Presto, How the Universe is Made. On your mark, one first original form. Get set. A second angular segment. Go. The next step, a rule, replacing each straight side in the first by the second. If I take a box, and for each side of that box, substitute a cone or peak to make a kind of star, then do again what I did before. Take the star box, and where I find a straight line, replace it with a peak to make a starrier star, nesting the shape even deeper in the figure, replacing peaks to make a star in the box or a diamond heart star at every level, a shape self-similar, a shape of extreme complication. In only a few, in five iterations, it already reads as texture and is rapidly sinking as it plummets, repeating into bonded lock where photons mediate, shunting between heavy center, vibrant orbit, or deeper look. No, look, a quantum leap. The burst box, the born star, is re-emerging on the line, or, and, repeat, on your mark, one first, and on it goes forever.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Stephanie. Thank you. So, you know, there's so much, as you say, you know, involved with technology in your work, and I noticed that in your signature on your email, you said there's a quote that says, "Raw data is an oxymoron,"
right?
Which I can't decode initially. I have some ideas about what that might mean, but what does that mean? Raw data is an oxymoron.
Because the idea of raw, when they say raw, is if it were somehow pristinely harvested out there, and there is no such thing. A really good book that describes this in detail is called The Weapons of Mass Destruction by Kathy O'Neill. But the point is, to collect any data at all, you have already made so many judgments about the categories that you're using to collect it, and the statistics that you're going to use to analyze it, and the affordances of the software that you're going to use, that it embodies all of the prejudices and biases that our science and society contain, by which this science and society was developed. So the idea that we can just go out and collect some data and this is going to solve stuff, we'll just sort of apply it, is a false one, in my view.
Yeah, that's clear now. But this is also such a huge part of what we're grappling with as a culture, isn't it? As we are, whether it's browsing the internet, it seems that more and more, I know the term big data is overused, and I admit I don't completely understand what that means, but it seems that enormous amount of our information is possessed by systems that are using algorithms or other methods to kind of serve us content, which in some ways makes it harder to find what we're looking for, perhaps. But is that part of what you're thinking about in the book that you mentioned, which sounds fascinating?
Well, yes, I do think about it all the time, and I think it, science and software itself has changed so much since I first started to do this. It's unbelievable, but, you know, in the early 1960s, there was no evidence of a Big Bang. By the 1970s, we could count back to the first second. And in the last 5 years, we've detected gravitational waves, we've understood exoplanets, the microwave background. Things are changing enormously fast, and people can't keep up with it. And we instead are training them to just look at this little rectangle in their hand, you know, and be distracted by whatever's being served to them, which is, I don't think, a very useful behavior. But it's being managed at the level of these proprietary algorithms by the hugest corporations known and richest, right? And that isn't the way it started in the mid-90s, and there's been many other things along the way, but there's not. There are people who are concerned with this, but it's very hard for the individual to resist it, you know? And the bodies of people and the way we are, we're just being shaped and evolving along with them because we do what we're trained to do and what we have to do. I mean, I don't have a cell phone. I refuse to have a cell phone. But it's a huge sacrifice, you know, and most people can't do that, right? So it's I agree with you that it's certainly a major issue for us all to confront. And how does it affect our language? I mean, there are many ways.
No, go on. You mean how does all this?
Well, there's this intersection of language and technology. There's been a bit of a fusion of body and screen. You know, people are getting their clues off a screen, or this idea of creating the personal space of performance that started back with a Portapak camera, but, you know, taking a selfie. We're used to living with disembodied beings like digital avatars, and there's just, we go to installations and galleries, and things are poised between what I would call the rendered and the real, the digital and the analog. I mean, I think of, I have a poem in which I quote Whitman's, where he's saying, and the child asks, what is the grass? And the children I know who ask that question are pressing the glass. They're not looking at the grass, right? That is grass to them. And so it's profound. It's profound change. We can't go back from it. We have to learn to live with it. I think somebody like Will Alexander, I feel very close to, because we have to match it with some kind of internal technology. We have to change our minds in order to live with it and not be captured by it. But that's another whole long story.
Well, it sounds like it would be good to talk again, because that does sound like a wonderful story that should be discussed. But I want to ask you the last question here, which is, what are you reading now? I'm always curious what everyone's reading, you're reading something very interesting.
I'm reading the collected essays of Ralph Ellison, and they're wonderful. It's a very old book, and fortunately I have access to the New York City library system, and I recommend it to anybody.
Stephanie, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been my pleasure.
Well, and mine too. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.